years or older, come down to Wind River Resort and Casino for our Senior Day promotion every Wednesday.
Play your River Club card on any of our favorite slot machines and receive 5x points from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m.
Don't forget to claim your bonus points at any of our promotional kiosks before you leave.
While you're in points, you can put your points back on your slot machine for more playtime or redeem your points for dining vouchers, gas vouchers, or a variety of other prizes at the River Club.
For more information, visit WindRiver.com or call 1-800-280-YOU-WIN.
Find your moment at Wind River Resort and Casino.
Hi there. It's a sunny reminder from Alliance Heating and Air. Thinking about going solar? Now's the time to act. The 30% federal solar tax credit may be ending December 31st, 2025. But if you install your system soon, you could still save an average of up to $12,700. Don't wait. Call Alliance Heating and Air at 530-221-2642 to lock in your savings. We make it simple. We make it smart. And that's why everybody calls us.
Everybody calls us.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
We don't even really have a scientific analysis of what we mean by general intelligence. We have these kind of hand-waving, you know, humans can do this and humans can do that. Wouldn't it be nice if machines could do that generally? You'll hear that word endlessly, but yeah, Nobody will ever define it.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Eric Larson, author of the book, The Myth of Artificial Intelligence, Why Computers Can't Think the Way We Do. We talk in depth with Eric about AI a little bit later on in today's program. First, we're joined by Dr. Richard Samuelson. He is Associate Professor of Government at Hillsdale College's Washington, D.C. campus. Dr. Samuelson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Discussing today an essay you recently had at Law and Liberty, James Madison and the Crisis of the New Order, and a discussion about returning American government to Republican, small r, principles. What's the role of myth in legitimizing a government or a regime? And what myths are key to the legitimization of our constitutional regime?
Well, myth is an interesting word. I think you need common beliefs about what just government is and what good government is in any functioning political order. And in our regime, it is a Republican or a Democratic Republic. So it's, Lincoln would say, of the people, by the people, for the people. And so that means that we, the people, get to participate actively in our government. And so in any functioning community, there are certain things that we hold to be self-evident. Now, in some cases, they may or may not be. Remember Jefferson's original draft of the Declaration, we hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable. And then in the middle, as Dr. West has pointed out, in the middle in his draft, in his denunciation of the slave trade, the king has been violating the sacred rights of humanity through slavery, and at the end, our sacred honor. So sacred, 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 beginning, middle, end. We hold these things as sacred, what is right. And we have essentially religious veneration for these truths that are at the heart of our regime. And in any community, there are certain truths, certain beliefs you have in common. Otherwise, there's got to be some common basis to have a functioning community.
Hmm. In the view of our founders, which branch of government was meant to create the laws, and which level, local, state, federal?
Well, in the founding era, it's easiest to describe the Constitution because Article 1 is Article 1 for a reason. The legislative power is supposed to be the most important one. And their discussion of creating government, say John Adams' 1776 Thoughts on Government, which Gordon Wood calls the most important pamphlet in helping people draft their first state constitutions between 1776 and, say, the early 1780s. And he starts off discussing the legislature. That's the most important thing. That is, we the people, through people reelect, are making our laws, those laws under which we will all live. That was seen as the fundamental power. Now remember, that's why Article 1, it says, it begins, all legislative powers herein granted. We don't have only a national government, right? In Federalist 39, it's partly national, partly federal. There are state and local government, right? In order to have a legislative process in which we participate, they believed it has to have a lot of local components. because the more distant the government is, the less say each individual has, the less we feel that we are participating in this fundamental process of lawmaking. And interestingly, just to point back behind that a little bit, it's not just legislation, right? We ratify our constitution. We create our fundamental laws. Now, that may be grounded in the principle of declaration, right? The second paragraph talks about our rights and goes in the same sentence to govern by the consent of the government, of the governed. So our right to consent to our laws and our right to consent to the Constitution all come from the same basic foundation.
What's the practical difference between a federal republic and a national republic? And to the point of your essay, what about Madison's conception of that difference?
Madison very much believed in a compound republic. That is, classically, republics are small, right? You have a small city-state polis because there's a republic. There's one public. There's one community in a very rich and thick sense. We all, in a sense, step on the same foot, have the same basic values in a very fundamental way. But republics, historically, have often not lasted very long. And so they study, John Adams in particular wrote 1,000 pages of history or so about the republics of ancient Greece and medieval Europe, and they tended to kind of rise and fall, but they're usually small. Madison thought, well, maybe if you combine the two, because our republic will be large, but a large republic means you don't have one way of life. It's too big. It's too diverse. There are too many different communities inside this republic. So in a sense, you have a confederation of republics where some partly national, partly federal. And though it's combining those two things, you can perhaps combine the benefits of Republican self-government without drawing off some of the dangers that happen because republics tend not to be long-lived. Just think, small towns are not known for unity. They're known for family feuds.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Dr. Richard Samuelson with us, Associate Professor of Government at Hillsdale College's Washington, D.C. campus. His recent essay at Law and Liberty, James Madison and the Crisis of the New Order, a phrase that we hear very often these days, the administrative state. Where do we see its origins, and have the administrative state members ever actually been the neutral regulators that they perhaps were intended to be?
Madison's very interesting. He thought, if we add a lot of power to the federal government, well, in Federalist 10, he says, we can solve the problem of republics by enlarging the sphere. Rather than the small factional fights you see in small towns, you'll have such a large republic that no faction will be able to get over 50% and therefore tyrannize the minority. Right? You need to have, if a faction is less than 50%, they don't win the vote, they can't write the laws. But if it's over 50%, you have a problem. But in a large, diverse republic, you have so many different factions and sects, etc., you're much less likely to get that. However, he says, at the end of the 1790s, if we add a lot of power to the federal government, you will, note the language, expand the sphere of the executive, because the legislature will not be able to do so many things. That power will be delegated to the executive, because Congress will simply not have the expertise to legislate on so many things. And also, in a large, diverse republic, it won't be reasonable to have the same rules that apply to, say, rural Maine, that apply to downtown New York, that apply to, say, the Port of Charleston. So you're going to have a lot by executive discretion. And Madison is worried that if you do that, the executive will either become corrupt because he'll use that discretion to get reelected, or the elections will become corrupt because people will be pushing so hard to get their guy as opposed to the other guy elected.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens is in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, people thought, oh, we have a solution you didn't think of, Madison. And that is, we have experts. The PhD in the social science was a new thing. So when we add people to government, we give this discretion to the administrative branch. It's not really the executive. These are neutral scientific experts doing what science would have them do. I mean, Woodrow Wilson says quite explicitly that this is not politics. It's science. Right? And so when you add all this power to Washington, D.C. under the executive in a nominal sense, they're really quasi-independent because they are supposed to be doing what science dictates. They are not being political. They're just making judgments according to what social science would have them make. So that's the underlying idea. And where is the place of democracy there? Well, in a general way, you have elections for Congress and for president who provide direction.
Mm-hmm.
But the key feature here is you don't have the problem Madison feared, because all this extra power is being done not through the political process. It's being done by disinterested, non-prejudiced social scientists who are making the judgments based on the neutral scientific process, as opposed to the grubby, merely political process that one would see in the legislature.
Talking with Dr. Richard Samuelson from Hillsdale in D.C. about returning American government to its Republican small r principles. More next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Reading, say big on Black Bear Diner's new basket bundles. Get your paws on a choice of sandwich, side, and drink for only $11. A great meal at a great price. Basket bundles, now available at Black Bear Diner. Be sure to stop by for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Black Bear Diner just added 4 brand new and 4 returning classics to the menu. Black Bear Diner, 2205 Hilltop Drive. Get big value and so many choices at Black Bear Diner.
Black Bear Diner.
The Ramsey Show.
You actually can help people, and you don't help them by giving them a government program. You help them by showing them the way out. People love me enough to put their arm around me and show me a different way. I didn't figure it all out in my own head. So there's a power to hope. That's not some kind of false panacea positive thinking way. It works. You can't positive think your way into everything, but you can't negative think your way into anything.
Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Join Aaron and Bill for We the People Radio, Sundays, noon until 2.
It's conservative talk radio with a liberal dose of humor. Get the whole story from experts around the world delivering facts rather than opinion.
Missed a show? Busy at noon? No problem. Listen to our free archives when you have time. No commercial interruptions or download restrictions. We the People Radio.
.us.
I'm here today with my insurance agent of about 12 years, Kevin Wall from Allstate. He's located at 2861 Churn Creek Road. Now, Kevin, what is it that has made you such a successful insurance office for, what, almost 30 years?
Yes, actually, 28 years, June 1st. And the fact that we genuinely care about our clients and want to do what's best to make sure we take care of their insurance needs.
I remember when my daughter had her accident, and Allstate and your office was right there to help with the claims process.
As I mentioned, we have great staff and customer service. We really do go the extra mile. And with Allstate, if you qualify for the California Good Driver discount, you can most likely get started with as low as 1 month down.
Now, do people have to wait until their renewal to get started?
No, absolutely not. Whether your policy is coming up for renewal now or if you're midterm, it really doesn't matter. We can usually get you covered within about 15 minutes from when you call. Whether it's auto, home, or anything else that needs insured, if you just give us a call or text us, we'd be glad to help you. 530-222-2306.
Attention veterans, did you know that Shasta College and Simpson University have veterans resource centers to assist you in your educational pursuits? These centers offer a wide range of support services, including financial aid, tutoring, IT support, and more. We understand the unique challenges that veterans face and are committed to helping you succeed. Our experienced staff is here to help you navigate the college experience and achieve your academic and career goals. Don't let anything stand in your way. This message is brought to you by Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of California Veterans Affairs.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We're talking with Dr. Richard Samuelson, Associate Professor of Government at Hillsdale College's Washington, D.C. campus, about a recent essay he penned on returning American government to Republican small r principles. Dr. Samuelson.
We have a government far, far bigger than one perhaps Madison even could have imagined. Are there particular ways that government this size can be re-republicanized?
Well, that's the huge question, right? Because it was not crazy. There are people who said, no, you're not right. But it was not crazy when the social science PhD was new to say, well, okay, these are neutral experts. But not many people really believe that anymore, as far as I can tell, except people with a very strong interest in believing it, either their personal career is based on it, or they're very much attached to this regime in somehow in their world. So the challenge is, how can we do that, right? And it's a real challenge. What do you do about that? Can you return power to legislature? That's a problem, because you're doing so darn many things via the executive, right? Mm-hmm. Can the legislature actually do that? One idea is, Jefferson has an idea. He writes to Madison when he's in France, and he's partly writing, worrying about debt. It's not fair to burden your children. So no laws, no constitutions, no debts should last longer than a generation. And being a math guy, Jefferson calculates that based on demographics at 19 years. Mm-hmm. So we should ratify a new constitution in every 19 years. That's when half the people who ratify the previous ones haven't been around or adults to ratify it. Also, debt should expire. Madison says, well, there's a lot of benefit from the veneration that laws being around for a while have. But I wonder if, at least to give the legislature some purchase on that, is to say, oh, any delegation of law writing shall only last a generation, say 19, 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so Congress would have to reauthorize, at least the Congress could weigh in every 20 years on whether they still have that power or how it needs to be changed. And that might be worth doing, because think about how we got the regulation of greenhouse gases. They used the early 1970s Clean Air Act, which is about smog and pollution of that sort. You're worrying about the air we breathe and such. And they used that late in the Bush administration, the W. Bush administration, in what, 2007, 2008, say, well, that also includes greenhouse gases and includes concern about global warming. In other words, they took a 40-year-old law and just rewrote it to meet a new purpose. And you can say, well, because they had to, it wasn't being done by Congress, blah, blah, blah. But if you had to revisit that statute every 20 years, then it would come up, and at least the people's representatives could revisit that explicitly. Mm-hmm. So that's one idea. Another idea is that any regulation of any significant cost, so if it's $100 million, you can't actually make that a law. You have to propose it to Congress, and they would have to pass it. The other question is, Congress's muscles have atrophied. They're not used to doing all of this kind of work. They would have to get back into legislating. And that itself would be a big transformation for Congress, to get back to the sense that their job is to be actively engaged in the details of legislation across the board.
Is it at all possible to return to the founders' view of the executive branch without dismantling the federal entitlement programs, the systems of Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, those?
Well, I think there are two different things. Sending checks to people is actually not a big problem from the perspective of separation of powers. There is discretion at the margin who gets it, who doesn't, for how much. But that is one thing. And it would be better to be closer to people, and it would be better to have regular votes on how much to give for what kind of thing and how it should be changed in light of changing circumstances. It could still be done, but it's hard. It's hard to take a benefit away once it's been given. Mm-hmm. But the real meat of the problem isn't in the meat of our budget problem. Our debt is in the entitlements, the handouts and entitlements we give. That's also, in a sense, might be bad for the citizenry. Dependency is not good for the soul, as Franklin Roosevelt noted, among others. And so we should try to say, yes, have a safety net, but in general, we should try, that should be a backstop, and we've moved away from that. So maybe to have a robust citizenry, we need to rethink that, and maybe that's too hard to lift politically. But the real problem from the perspective of the administrative state is all the regulatory power that the federal government can use to nudge both universities and they're called non-governmental organizations. They should be called government-backed organizations because they take federal money or government money. And then huge parts of the private sector. The government can – there are so many rules, so many regulations. They can play their regulatory hand to change the way the private sector behaves. And then you collapse the distinction between civil society and government. And so what you're doing in a sense is you're moving towards the spirit of a small republic where everybody's on the same page, stepping with the same foot. Literally, that is, our daily lives are very, very similar in a small town. We have a common way of life. But you try to move that spirit into a large republic where it would be tyranny to try to force us all to have the same common way of life. And so that those two fights are related. But it's really the real problem isn't the check sending part. It's the regulatory part, because that's where you've taken the law writing element of the government away from the people's representatives and put it to unelected technocrats. And given back to the question of myth, once people no longer believe they are politically neutral, I think COVID really made a lot of people see that that's a problem, because anytime you have a trade-off between two competing goods, say, which people should you bias towards, the elderly who are more dangerous to COVID or the youngs need to go to education? That's a political choice. That is not a scientific choice.
Right. Is it possible that civil law can replace the role of some of these regulatory commissions in exercising justice in these areas?
In some ways, what can you do? Well, I know some people like Richard Epstein think a lot of this could be done by torts.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you can sue people for causing too much pollution. You would have to resurrect some of the old common law understanding and then modify it. To give you an example, and I wouldn't know exactly how the modifications would work, but in the 19th century, as you started to get industrial organizations, businesses, large factories, the laws that had pre-existing were for the small shops. You know, the rules in a blacksmith shop, if you got hurt in a blacksmith shop, it's more likely than not you messed up somehow. Now, if you're a trainee, maybe not. Mm-hmm. Right? But once you're in working for a large, you're working on a train and the engine blows up, right? If you're in a factory, it is quite possible it was not your doing. Something went wrong with the machine. The tort system was biased towards a small shop. It had to be recalibrated to have the just result in light of the creation of large businesses and large machines. And there might be some of that necessary if you're going to do this via the tort system, to recalibrate for the realities of modern business, given the internet, and given the amount of things that we're doing by automation nowadays. I haven't thought about that thing how, but that is one possibility to do more things through private actions, where you have a claim of harm, and you can do it through the tort system. Tort lawyers would love this, of course, but I think too, on the back end, you would have to reform the abuses that seem to have crept into our tort system too.
Hmm. Dr. Richard Samuelson, Associate Professor of Government at Hillsdale College's Washington, D.C. campus. You can find his essay at Law and Liberty, James Madison and the Crisis of the New Order. Dr. Samuelson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Up next, Eric Larson here on campus as part of our CCA lecture series on artificial intelligence. We'll talk about his book, The Myth of Artificial Intelligence. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, this is Chuck Kinney, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. Have you been affected by some of the recent changes in business ownership here in Shasta and Tehama counties? These changes follow a national trend where national companies buy up locally owned small family companies and change the culture and staff and pricing of their product. That has occurred here in the North State also. Three locally owned propane companies have been purchased by large national companies. If you're like me and you prefer to deal with locally owned companies, you may be interested to know Shasta Gas Propane, which has been around for 28 years, now has the third generation working in the company. For locally owned, family operated service and care, give us a call at 530-365-3793. Thank you.
Hello there, this is Kevin Cry. Every other Sunday, I will be on KCNR, your talk radio, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. I will be discussing the issues that matter to you most. You'll be able to call in directly, ask questions, and have a dialogue open and free every other Sunday right here on KCNR, your talk radio.
Looking for work? O2 Employment Services has been working with local job seekers for the past 20 years. If you're tired of uploading your resume and getting no response, it's time to let O2 help you find that perfect position. Oh, and by the way, you pay absolutely nothing for our service. If you'd like our help, head on over to our website at o2es.com, click apply now, and complete our online application. We have connections with over 600 local businesses. Once we have your information and understand what you're looking for, we can introduce you to all the positions you may wish to consider. We currently have over 100 available positions, and we would love to match you with the one you're looking for. O2 Employment Services, the North State's leading staffing agency. Give us a call at 530-223-4674. That's 530-223-4674. Or visit us online at o2es.com.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Hey, it's your liberty-loving Latino amigo, Rich Valdez, host of America at Night. Weeknights, we're letting you know what's happening live all across America. We'll have newsmakers and experts coming on, talking about the hot topics of the day. Plus, in our third hour, whatever you want to talk about with open phones across America, our nightly town hall. I look forward to hearing from you on the next America at Night with me, Rich Valdez.
Weeknights from 7 to 10 p.m. on KCNR.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network wherever you find your audio, including YouTube, or at podcast.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Eric J. Larson. He's the author of The Myth of Artificial Intelligence, Why Computers Can't Think the Way We Do. You can also find him on Substack writing at Colego. Substack and look for that. Eric J. Larson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. You're here on campus as part of our CCA lecture series on artificial intelligence and talking about that question, why computers can't think the way we do. I want to give listeners sort of an overview first. There is so much discussion about AI, artificial intelligence, what it can do, what it can't do. Is it friendly? Will it be harmful? When we talk about artificial intelligence as this big entity, what exactly do we mean?
Right. So the field has a kind of storied history going back to the 50s. I think the original sort of kickoff point was this conference that they had in Dartmouth in 1956, and kind of the smartest guys in math. There was no computer science department back then, but Herb Simon in economics and so on. And people sort of converged and said, we have this new thing, a computer. How do we program it to do things that human minds do? And so it started out from the outset with that really aggressive, kind of ambitious goal of reproducing human cognition. And I think that's still what animates the field, and that's still what's assumed by people. But, you know, sort of the backstory is that we're actually not doing that. We are developing really powerful systems, but we're not, that original goal is not actually where we're headed. So there's a lot of confusion around that. I try to clear that up when I write.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a couple of camps, right? There are people who are really excited about artificial intelligence and what it can do and how it can help us and make our lives easier. And there's a group that's a little afraid of what AI can do and what it might do to us and what it might mean for humans. Is one of those groups perhaps on the right path? Is there a mixture of emotions we should feel about the advancement of artificial intelligence?
Right. So I think, yeah, I've called this before, you know, dreamy AI, which is this idea that it's going to kind of bring heaven on earth.
Hmm.
And fearsome AI, which is this idea that it's going to just ruin everything. That's the kind of Terminator model. I think both of those are kind of imaginative extensions of what's actually a more, you know, quotidian, science of, you know, programming computers to draw various conclusions that we need and to analyze data in a way that we find helpful. And so, you know, that whole debate does, for whatever reason, it just, you cannot extirpate that from, mm-hmm. from the discussion about AI. But either one of those scenarios, I think, are more mythology than they are anything that we actually do as computer scientists. And, you know, AI is this interesting field where everybody has an opinion about it. But, you know, and so there's kind of, it's very difficult to kind of draw a circle around AI and say, like, it's just going to be this stuff. And so I'm of two minds. Part of me thinks this is ridiculous. People are worried that the AI is going to come alive and take over, or we're going to upload our brains, you know, in the heaven case. All of this is just based on ideology, you know, and religious impulses and so on, and misplaced in technology. And the other part of me thinks, like, it's a fight that you can't, you know, win. So just let them talk, and the truth sort of comes out over time.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, but both of those scenarios I don't find likely at all, frankly.
Talking with Eric J. Larson. He is the author of The Myth of Artificial Intelligence, Why Computers Can't Think the Way We Do. You're a computer scientist as well. You've been in this field for a while, if I'm not mistaken, at one point working for a company that was developing an AI model of its own. Have your views on AI changed from perhaps that point to now?
Actually, no. So I started working in the field. I graduated with my master's in December of 99 at the University of Texas at Austin. In January of 2000, I started working at a AI company. It's known as PsyCorp. It's mm-hmm. good old fashioned AI. It's the old symbolic approach. They've been around forever since the 80s. So I like to joke that I've been, for the entire millennia so far, I've been working in AI. I didn't go the academic route. I've actually worked for companies, Fortune 500 companies. I worked for electronic data systems. I've started two companies. Founded one with DARPA funding from the Department of Defense in 2007. I ran that until 2012, and co-founded another one in the education space in 2016. So I've been involved in actually building the systems. But my view about the bigger picture of AI has never fundamentally changed. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the more that I actually work in a hands-on capacity building these systems, the more I think that the real highfalutin sort of visions about it are silly. And, you know, it's funny. There are some very, very smart people who know the science of the field who also, like Stuart Russell, mm-hmm. You know, who also talk about this worry about alignment and so on, which is kind of code for it's going to decide it wants to get out of its, you know.
The Terminator problem.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Like the Terminator. Yeah. And so, you know, I don't know, but I've never been particularly swayed by that instinct to attach those kind of broad, you know, conceptual frameworks to this thing that we're doing. But yeah, my background has enabled me to write. I'd like to believe that it's enabled me to write clearly about the topic.
Uh-huh.
So yeah.
The topic of your lecture here at Hillsdale College, part of our CCA lecture series on artificial intelligence, is why computers can't think the way we do. And I read you writing recently and saying machines don't interact dynamically with their environment the way biological intelligence does. That seems to be a big point.
Yeah.
What does that mean? And how does say AI differ from, I think another article you wrote was, how is AI different from a 5-year old too? So how does AI not work with their environment in a way that humans do interact with their environments?
Right. So probably the easiest entry point into this kind of a discussion is, you can ask yourself why language models or large language models like ChatGPT have this kind of amazing ability to interact with us in a conversational capacity. And we can kind of, you know, I call it knowledge resonance, where I know some things, but it has access to more information. And so that back and forth actually results in a net positive for me. But if you take that and go out into the physical world, it thinks that the words on the internet are actually the world itself. So it doesn't think at all. But what I'm saying is that there's this kind of assumption. The designers of that system drew a big circle around the text, you know, that we generated, humans generated on the web. And so what it's doing is basically playing in this universe of words, and it doesn't have reference points to those words. So if you try to sort of improve self-driving cars, you'll notice that self-driving cars are stuck. We don't have level 5 autonomy. That's because we don't have AI systems that actually understand that there's a real world out there. I mean, so the cyber world is not the real world. And anytime you have a difference like that, you're going to have a degradation of performance, and you're going to see the breakdown in the system. So, yeah. So we're actually embedded in our environments. We came from the earth, as the Bible says, we came from the earth, and to the earth we shall return. And so, but that gives us a kind of insurmountable edge in terms of cognition. We're not just brains and vats. We're actually embedded in our environments. Mm-hmm. We can feel, smell, think. And in that way, our sort of rationality is very ecological, and it spreads out among us, and social. And we can't do that by programming a machine. Yeah.
Taking your example of the self-driving automobile, self-driving car, and thinking about this point, there are signs and signals that drivers make to each other. You get to a four-way stop, and two of them are kind of the same time, and someone says, go ahead, waves to you, right? You can go.
Yeah.
Or there's a crash, you've got to merge into a single lane, and not everyone's going to do the zipper, and sometimes people will try to jump in front of you, or someone will let you go. Are those the kind of things, you know, interacting with the environment that a self-driving car might never be able to understand?
Yeah, I mean, they call them edge cases in the field, and really the edge cases are, they're more than edge cases. They're like the real life that the system can't grab, can't accommodate. You know, so you have examples of a self-driving car sitting at a four-way stop, and the other driver, the human driver's waving them on, like, you go first, and it just won't budge.
Mm-hmm.
And so all those cases just kind of fall outside of the training data that we give those systems. The variety and the number and the diversity of scenarios that you'll encounter in the world driving means that that's a Sisyphean task, I think.
That's Eric Larson. We're talking about why computers can't think the way we do. More next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This season, Hunter Roofing is stepping up to the plate. As proud sponsors of Colt 45's baseball, we're cheering on every home run and keeping your home protected. From storm repairs to full replacements, trust the pros who bring quality to every job. Hunter Roofing, where quality meets the sky. Support local, keep your home in winning shape, and root for the Colt 45s. Visit hunterroofing.org today.
Looking for fun ways to explore your town? You've got to step into the Cascade Curation Store, the coolest, cleanest little thrift store and art galleria in Shasta County. We're talking vintage without the markup, prices that'll make your bank account happy, one-of-a-kind local artwork for your art collectors, and curated thrifty finds you won't discover anywhere else in town. Whether you're hunting for that perfect piece to complete your collection or just browsing for inspiration and want to explore downtown and get free parking, for us, it's not just about vibes or trends. It's about timeless quality, where every visit is a new adventure at Cascade Curations.
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel is a full-service organization with department staff with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is financial advisor Susan Eastman at 530-244-7199. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Again, that number, 530-244-7199.
John Cruz here with America Outdoors Radio. Be sure to tune in this weekend and catch the latest in fishing, hunting, conservation, and destinations. If you love spending time in the field or on the water or in the woods, you're going to love this show. It's America Outdoors Radio, the fastest growing outdoors radio show in the nation. Tune in Saturdays from noon to 1 p.m. on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM KCNR, your talk radio.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. She had minor damage to her rear bumper. I wrote her an estimate. Later, I received a call. The lady responsible for the damage wanted to pay for the repairs out of pocket. Her insurance agent told her a claim would raise her rates for years. With our experience in the claim process, I explained to her most insurance companies would forgive a claim if the cost was below a minimum amount. I suggested she contact her insurance agent and have them review her policy. She called back very excited. It appeared her policy did extend forgiveness. They would pay for the repairs and she wouldn't be charged with a claim or have to pay a deductible. The accident would not cost her a thing. She was very pleased. Good thing the vehicle owner came to the right place for repairs. We all pay a lot for insurance. Choosing Coachmaster will ensure you get the most for your money. Let this experience work for you. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We're talking with Eric J. Larson, writer, entrepreneur, computer scientist. He's the author of The Myth of Artificial Intelligence, Why Computers Can't Think the Way We Do. Eric, AGI, Artificial General Intelligence. What's the difference between straight AI and AGI? And is the reasons we've been discussing why we might not get to AGI?
Yeah, absolutely. And so this is the AGI is the dream that Turing, the original Alan Turing, sort of the pioneer of AI, had. And interestingly, when he said if we could have a conversation with our computer, then we'd have no reason not to ascribe to it mind. And so the AGI was a term coined to capture what AI was originally supposed to be, which was this kind of general intelligence that we have. And by general, I mean, contrasted with narrow, you have a computer that can play chess, or you have a computer that can play Go, or you have a computer that can identify cancer in images and so on. But you can't take that same system and give it some other problem. You have to redevelop the system from scratch. You have a new data set. All kinds of things have to happen. So narrow AI has defined the field, but the dream is general AI, which is kind of what we do. Like, we can have this conversation and then you can go out and drive the car. And then later we can be manipulating a fork and a spoon, you know, robotics, right? Like, we're doing all these amazing things and we just do them naturally. And so the AI scientist is trying to figure out, how do I make this capacity not just for one thing, but for everything? And, you know, we don't have, this is, you know, the best that we've been able to do is, I call it wide AI, which is you have a very large analysis of a small world, which is what ChatGPT does. We don't really know what it would mean to have computers with general intelligence like we have. And it's just kind of it's a dream that always sits about 10 years up in front. But it's not even really well analyzed by the people in the field. Like, we are using these words like general intelligence, but we don't even really have a scientific analysis of what we mean by general intelligence. We have these kind of hand waving, you know, humans can do this and humans can do that. Wouldn't it be nice if machines could do that generally? But nobody's really tacked that down. So yeah, that's what's going on with that. You'll hear that word endlessly, but yeah, Nobody will ever define it.
if AGI is not an endpoint or an achievable point for artificial intelligence, what is, like, what would be a maxing out of its potential?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I think I have a view that we're at this kind of last extension of the machine learning paradigm, which began really decades ago and really kind of went on steroids with the success of the web in the early 2000s. Suddenly we have just volumes of text, audio, video that are available for training. And so, you know, I was in the field when we were using these other machine learning approaches support vector machines and maximum entropy. We had all these different ways of taking a bunch of data and basically doing something with it. And neural networks kind of didn't work very well. And so what we discovered was if you multiply the amount of data by 10 or by 100, they work really well. And so we had deep learning in the early 2010s. But I think like what we've done now, like to answer your question, how do we get sort of what's the end game? I think what we have now is the end game and we need a radical new innovation. I don't like what we're doing in the field right now is basically making the large models larger. This is not a fundamental step, right? So I think we've reached this kind of endpoint in machine learning as we understand it. And the power that we got from these models is like amazing, but it's nowhere near what we do as humans. And if we want to try to, and I don't even think it's actually worthwhile to pursue AGI, we can just have children. Like we don't need to bring, like what we need is something that's smart in a way that we are not.
Right.
Right. Like we need a calculator, you know, on steroids. Like we don't need a person complaining and, you know, and so on. Like we already have that. So I don't think that's actually a scientifically laudable goal to get to AGI. But if we're going to do that, we can't just keep going down the same track that we're on. I think we're at the end of this machine learning paradigm.
Eric J. Larson with us. Find him writing at Substack. Again, the lecture, Why Computers Can't Think the Way We Do. I want to ask, can computers be creative in the way we are? Meaning there's concern in journalism. You have computers or AI that can write articles, can have them published. In the world of music, perhaps, in the world of art, you know, creative design, those sorts of things. Can AI be creative in the way that humans are creative?
I mean, the short answer is no. And if you look at how large language models work, it becomes really obvious. So what we do is we supply a sequence of tokens or words. We call it a prompt. And then we ask it to complete that prompt. So what we're doing is basically setting a domain or a topic basically within which we're going to converse. And, you know, part of this is good. Like you don't want to, you know, talk with another human being and say like, what's the weather like? And they start explaining the price of steel or something like that's not how conversations work. But we always have the ability to sort of incorporate another domain that's not determined by, you know, by what's been said directly. And the machine actually has to complete that prompt. And so it's very domain constrained in what it does. And that translates to it's not going to be creative. You're not going to have a machine where you start the prompt with Newtonian mechanics and it ends up with special relativity. If you did this in 1904 before special relativity came out in 1905, right? So imagine we have this huge conceptualization of the universe and all, you know, and imagine, if you will, that we have these AI systems right before that. There would be no way that they could actually reach that. It's not in the training data and it's not determined by the domain that you've given it for the prompt. So they're very good at supplying facts and knowledge and even sort of brainstorming within which the domain that you've specified for them. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of value in them, frankly, in doing this. I think of them in practical terms. I think of it like we have Google search. Now we have LLMs. Another way to look at what I'm saying about the non-creative, limitations. What happens is, and I've seen this happen and it's hilarious. If let's say you're prodding the LLM, ChatGPT-4, what have you, to help come up with a novel scientific theory or a novel theory about X, whatever X is. And it will, because it doesn't actually have the ability to actually think about the thing and come up with something, it will, in trying to please you, which is the way it's been trained, right? It's just really trying to give you a satisfying answer. Mm-hmm. And so it will just start inventing citations for non-existent scientific works, right? Mm-hmm. In an effort to fulfill your request of having something new to think about. So that tells you right there, like when you sort of, you know, push it against the wall and say like, let's innovate, it'll just start inventing stuff.
Yeah.
It doesn't have any way of doing that. And, you know, that's just not a limitation that we have in principle. Yeah.
Yeah. Final question for Eric J. Larson. I read someone the other day say, if you haven't found a way that AI can help you, you're not thinking about it the right way, right? AI can be helpful in your life. Do you encourage people to sort of experiment to use AI in various forms to find those ways it can be helpful?
Absolutely. I think, you know, in a kind of ironic sense, if you look at a technology like LLMs, like ChatGPT, and you try to wall it off and say there's something wrong with it, you're actually perpetuating this mythology about stuff. It's so dangerous. And so I think it's information technology that we can use. We can discover sort of how best to do that in education, you know, in different industries. The legal has a problem because of that. Its tendency to hallucinate non-existent court cases. More than one junior lawyer has probably been fired by now. But I mean, these are human problems that we can solve. And this is part of our IT infrastructure at this point. And I don't see any reason why we should have this, you know, sort of hands-off, you know, approach to stuff that frankly these technologies can help a lot. I use ChatGPT as a research assistant, you know. And so, you know, if I was a millionaire writer, you know, and I'd have a team of human people when I'm working on a new book with MIT Press, you know, so I use that as a sort of, you know, $20 a month research assistant. I don't let it drive. Mm-hmm. I write, you know, my prose is my prose. What I write is what I write, but I don't see any reason why we shouldn't have a healthy attitude towards the tech, and it's not going away. So we might as well do it anyway.
Right.
Like, good luck getting rid of the stuff.
Eric J. Larson is the author of The Myth of Artificial Intelligence, Why Computers Can't Think the Way We Do. You can also find him writing at Substack. Look for Eric J. Larson. Eric, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks very much.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Richard Samuelson from Hillsdale in D.C. and Eric Larson, author of The Myth of Artificial Intelligence. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm Jack Potter, Jr., Tribal Chairman for Redding Rancheria. We've proudly partnered with the Redding Rodeo Association for Native American Appreciation Night. As you know, our roots and hearts are here in this community and are proud of this partnership. From grants to help local businesses and government, to making health care available to so many, to our own community events like the Stillwater Powwow that happens right here on this same land. Redding Rancheria is proud to play our part.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
Hi, I'm Steve Coburn, proud owner of Country Air Pet Resort here in Redding. I invite you to come and take a tour of my revitalized pet resort. Our goal here at Country Air is to make sure your pet can relax and have a healthy, happy time away from home. With friendly, caring people, lots of fresh air and exercise, good healthy food, and plenty of pampering. There are no small cages here. What we offer are large temperature-controlled runs and spacious exercise yards that are great for fun and socialization. We even offer daycare. Cats are treated to a two-room apartment plus playtime in our playroom. So stop by and take a tour of the best. You and your pet will want to come back to Country Air Pet Resort, where our motto is, we treat your pets as if they were our own. Country Air Pet Resort, 549-3335.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year, we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website, havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history.
I'm Nathan with the Reading Trail Alliance, and we're here at the Reading Bike Park. We just want to thank the Reading Rancheria for all the help they've given us over the years supporting the many projects we're doing for our community.
Hi, I'm Dan, and this is Donna, and we're with Wings of Angels.
And we'd like to thank the Reading Rancheria for their continued support over the years to our foundation.
Reading Rancheria. Proud to play our part.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.